And even though some of the background may be in many ways, I think they correlate for our own more closely than some of the other Old Testament times, the times of kings and times of miracles and whatnot. If you think about the people, they had come back from captivity. Idolatry was really not a problem anymore. They were dedicated to God, to Jehovah. That was the one true God. But yet, they struggled with, as I think we all have to deal with, is becoming complacent, becoming maybe a little lethargic, not as being as zealous as they need to be, not being as careful as they need to be. All of these things were temptations and struggles that they had to deal with. There was work that needed to be done, but people got preoccupied, taking care of their own lives, building their own houses, their own family houses. And the work of God just kind of went to the back burner. So I think if you think about that for a little bit, and think about our own lives, what we see in all the churches around us that we have any interaction with, I think you'll see there's a lot of strong parallels and a lot of good points for application for us to think about. In Nehemiah, one of the key things I think we're going to see is the qualifications of a leader. The strengths, the characters, the virtues of a leader. And that's one of the lessons I want us to think about as we go through the text tonight. I want you to think about. Alright, so tonight we're going to be talking about rebuilding the walls. I'm going to flash before you the chart we've seen before. Main point is, we're at 445 B.C. This is the time of Nehemiah, and this is the time of the third return back to Jerusalem. This is the time when the walls are to be rebuilt. And this is the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign. Another chart that you've seen before. Again, the main point is we're on the last king right before the 400 years of silence. This is the time of Artaxerxes, Longimanus, as he's known in history. And he was the king when Ezra returned in 458. He's the king when Nehemiah returns in 445. And we presume that he's also the time of Malachi as well. But he's the last one before we get into the other kings that reign during the years of silence. Alright, today's outline, we're going to primarily go through the first seven chapters of Nehemiah. Obviously, we're going to be kind of hitting the high points, but I think this is so rich in application. I'm going to kind of let the narrative slip to the back burner a little bit. I'm going to try to focus on the application. I'll be kind of in a hurry, but don't hesitate to raise your hand, make comments, make points. This is going to be a great time and a great class to do that very thing. Alright, if you got your questions, question number one, and I'll go ahead and answer real quick. Does anybody not have the questions tonight? Lesson 17. Alright, question number one that I want you to think about is, what are the lessons to be learned from Nehemiah's response to the king's inquiry? What we're going to do, we're going to look at the opening of Nehemiah and look at the situation. The first thing I want you to notice is how Nehemiah was in Shushan, the citadel, and one of his brothers, and I believe we find out later that it possibly is his brother, Hananiah, came, and Nehemiah was concerned. He asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped to survive the captivity, concerning Jerusalem. That was his concern. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So it was, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. So the first thing I'd like for us to think about is compare ourselves to Nehemiah. What did Nehemiah exemplify, first of all, here?
Concern.
He identifies with his people. He's concerned about his people. He's seeking them out. He wants to know, how are they doing? How are things going? What is the state of Jerusalem? And then when he heard about the great distress and the reproach, what was his reaction? Was this just kind of a shallow concern? You know, what's the news? What's the latest? No. I mean, he is deeply distraught. He sits down, he weeps, he mourns for many days, he's fasting, he's praying. This is not just a surface concern, this is a deep and troubling concern that Nehemiah has here. So that's the first thing I'd like for us to think about. Are we aware of what's going on around us? Do we think about the church? Do we think about the Lord's people? Do we think about our friends, our family, our neighbors, co-workers? We have one elder in the room, but I like for us to think about, not so much from the perspective of an elder, but as parents, as teachers, as husbands, as fathers and mothers, and as I said, parents and children. We have great influence on so many people. We have opportunities to be a leader in so many different ways. So all of us, I think, need to be thinking about this and comparing ourselves to Nehemiah. Am I aware of what's going on around me? Am I concerned? Am I paying attention? Or where is my focus? Is it just in myself? So first of all, Nehemiah is distressed. And then, just briefly want to touch on his prayer. Very similar to the prayers that we've seen from Ezra, that we've seen from Daniel. Again, identifying with God's people, confessing the sins of God's people, but also including his own sins, the sins of his family, and identifying with all those. And again, hearkening back to the Lord's promise, the Lord's commandment. Remember, I pray the word that you commanded. Not that God forgot, but he wants God to act. He wants him to act on this promise. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest parts of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. His prayer is that God's ear would be attentive to his prayer, that he would be listening to him, to the prayer of his servants, and that his servant would prosper, and specifically, that he would be granted mercy in the sight of this man. He was a cupbearer before the king. And again, I like for us to think about, was Nehemiah bred a special way or given special opportunities or special positions? He was before the king, but yet he was a cupbearer. He's not a bred, a natural leader, if you will. He's a servant. And so his interest is taking advantage of this opportunity that God's given him, and he's asking God for additional opportunity. So the next thing we see in the narrative is that he comes before the king. And of course, what is Nehemiah's reaction? Again, his distress is not a surface one. This is something that he cannot really hide or really hold back. And so he sat in front of the king. And the king notices and says, "Why are you sad? You're not sick. This is nothing but the sorrow of the heart." And he became dreadfully afraid. Why was Nehemiah afraid? What was the big deal if the king saw him sad? No sadness was to be allowed in that presence, right, before the king. Everyone was to be joyful. Even if they didn't feel like it, they were to put on a happy face. And the king could have removed their head if they were not. So he's very afraid, but yet, does he apologize? What does he do?
He's honest.
He's honest, and he takes advantage of his opportunity. And he tells them, he's transparent, he tells them exactly what his problem is. Why should my face not be sad? Again, imagine that you're the servant, and you're speaking to the king. He has the authority and the rights and the custom of striking down those who don't have the proper face. And yet, he's using this opportunity. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tomb, lies in waste, and its gates are burned with fire? Then the king said to me, "Well, what's your request?" And how does Nehemiah respond at this time? That's very, very interesting. We're going to see that about Nehemiah over and over and over again. That he's a man of prayer. And that whenever any kind of trouble, any kind of thing threatens upon him, what's the first thing he does? He prays. Now, this is not the praying like Daniel three times a day, going to, as his custom. This is just whenever it's needed, whenever it's necessary, he's very quick to do that. And you see him even as he's writing the book, and as he's thinking back on the events, he's stopping to pray, ask God's help, or ask God to judge or do something about this. Again, a tremendous example of praying without ceasing. So the king, he gives his request that he would like to go and lead another return and to rebuild the walls. And the long and short of it is the king was accepted his offer. And notice what Nehemiah says. This was granted to him according to the good hand of my God upon me. So we see three responses. We see Nehemiah responding, we see the king responding, and we see God responding to Nehemiah's prayer. He's granting him his request. Alright, so our next section of the narrative, we've got two questions I'd like for us to think about as we go through this. What was the reaction of the people and their enemies to Nehemiah's plan as he returns to Jerusalem? And what were some of the difficulties that some of the families overcame as they helped in the rebuilding? Yes, please.
You're talking about him being a cupbearer. He's got to be a trusted servant of the king.
Mm-hmm.
So there's got to be some kind of rapport there. You trust him even though he had that relationship with the king, though he's not afraid. He was still afraid to be sad in his presence. So he still respected the king. Mm-hmm. Back to the first question, he still had respect for the king and for his authority and all that, what he's supposed to do. But he also had a relationship with him close enough that he would listen to it and also had his trust.
And I think that's a good point. It kind of goes back to the point that we've been making earlier, is look at how, whether we're talking about Nehemiah, or we're talking about Esther, Mordecai, or Daniel, all these people, how they're building relationships, and people know about them, and there's some kind of rapport, that they're just not completely isolated from the people that are around them, that there's some relationship, some respect there. So the king sends an army of horsemen with him, and the first thing we see is that as he comes in, that Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and later we learn of a couple of others, they're deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. All right, and I want to pause for a minute before we get back to the enemies, just to kind of make a quick point. It's a nuance, but I think it's a good point of wisdom. The first thing that Nehemiah did after he was there is at night, he went out with a few of his servants, and they surveyed the walls. They went around the city as best they could, and they got up in a position where they could look at the walls and see what the condition was of the city before they actually did anything else. And I think that's a really good point for us to think about as well. Again, going back to our theme, comparing ourselves to Nehemiah, are we aware of needs or problems that may go around us? Have we taken the time to survey the walls, if you will? Do we have a plan? Do we have something in action? Have we walked circumspectly and looked at it from all angles so that we can understand the situation and realize the need and then devise some kind of plan, something to do about it? And just the wisdom that he shows as a leader at this time, I think, is commendable. All right, now the reaction of the leaders. So he comes in the next day after he does this, and he tells them, "You see the distress that we're in, how Jerusalem lies in waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the walls of Jerusalem." And I told them of the hand of my God, which has been good upon me, and also the king's words that had spoken to me. So they said, "Let us rise up and build." Then they set their hands to this good work. Now this is very commendable. What could their reaction have been?
Fear.
Fear?
And not want to do it.
Right. Right. Why not? Because of all the enemies that are around, this would not be something that would be unknown to them. What else could their reaction have been? Apathy. I mean, it's, the walls have sat dormant for, I think, going on almost 100 years. I mean, why should we start working on them now? Go back to the lesson from Haggai. This is not the time. Could have been a reaction of pride, too, right? And here they are, the leaders of the city. Nehemiah says, "You see the distress. Let us rise up and build." They could have said, "Well, who are you to tell us to build?" But they listen and they say, "Let us rise up and build." So, it's a commendable reaction on their part as well. And then Nehemiah, of course, provides the reason why they should build. The fact that God's with them and has blessed them so far. So God's in their favor and the king is also in their favor. So all this is plenty of encouragement for them. All right, now getting back to the enemies. So Sanballat, Tobiah, and then Geshem the Arab heard of it. And they laughed, they despised us. They said, "What is this thing you're doing? Will you rebel against the king?" So what's the innuendo there? What's the implication? You're starting to build. Are you going to be traitors? Are you going to rebel? You can think back to how the temple was stopped previously with that same kind of accusation. But how does Nehemiah respond? The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we are his servants. We, his servants, will arise and build. They had a work to do. And then he reminds them they have no heritage or rival memorial in Jerusalem. They were Samaritans or Ammonites. They were Canaries. Alright, so the next thing that happens is the work is allocated by family. Each family, or I shouldn't say each and every, but some families were given sections of the wall to rebuild. And I want you to notice how each family demonstrated a work ethic. So just kind of pick out a few points. Elijah the high priest rose up with his brethren the priests, and they built a particular gate and hung its doors.
And then next to them, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. So here were some people, they were kind of too good for the work. This was something they couldn't do. For whatever the reason, they wouldn't do it. Nehemiah recognizes the work of the Lord, but they're not going to bend their backs to do it. The high priests, goldsmiths, perfumers, all these people could have said, I'm not a construction person. I don't build walls. This is not what I do. I'm a goldsmith. I make perfume. I'm the high priest. But yet, what were they doing? They were building. They each had a section of the wall. The leader of half the district of Jerusalem, he made repairs. Next to him was Shallum, the son of Kaloahesh, leader of half the district of Jerusalem. He and his daughters made repairs. So here's a man, apparently without sons, without sons that are able to work. But is that deterring him? Is that stopping him from doing it, having a part in the work? Nope. He's out there with his daughters, and they're out there doing the work. Here's a man who's recommended or committed as doing carefully repairing a section. Here's the Tekoites again. The same people that their nobles didn't put their shoulders to the work. They didn't stop them. They didn't prevent them from doing it. But one section of the wall was not enough for them. They went ahead and did a second section. So we see different work ethics. For the most part, strong, good work ethics. But we see some who are not as committed. So this leads us into our next question we're going to look at in a second. Why were the walls constructed so rapidly? How did Nehemiah compensate for the problems that were facing the people? So before we get into that, how do you think? What was the reason why the walls were built so quickly? They had a mind to work. Thank you. Excellent segue. So there was continuing to be threats. Sanballat was very indignant, mocked them. He had the army of Samaria, so it appears that he may have been in some way ruler or official or governor of the Samaritan province or the Samarian province, and he had an army there. They're mocking them. Can they complete it in a day? Yeah, there's a discouragement whenever we undertake any kind of work that may take an extended period of time. You can't get it done in a day. This is the same discouragement they were having to face. Tobias says that if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Again, this idea of, well, who are you? You're such a little people. How can you possibly accomplish something like this? You can't do this. You're not up to this task. And what's the response? Hear, O our God. Again, here's one of these energetic prayers right in the middle of the recording. For we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. So let them know what we've known. For they have provoked you to anger before the builders, and so we built the wall. And the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. That was the reason why they were able to get it done so quickly, is they had this attitude, they had this focus, they had this primary concern of getting the work done. This is a slide I borrowed from a presentation from the Young People's. And I just want to borrow a few passages from here. The lazy man says, there is a lion outside. I shall be slain in the streets. If we want to, there is always an excuse, some reason not to do the work that's given to us to do, that needs to be done. It may be ridiculous, it may be crazy, but if we're not careful, it's something we can use to rationalize, even though sensible people will see right through it. And we're not going to have time to touch on all these. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. There will always be a better day, a better opportunity. Today is not the day. Let's just wait till tomorrow. Tomorrow will be better. All of these things were something these people must have mastered, as we can see by their work ethic and what they went through to get the job done. So let's look at Nehemiah focusing on the threat of violence. So at this point, the enemies are actually planning to mount a physical attack. They're going to violently come in as an army, and they're going to stop what they're doing. And so they conspire together. And again, what's the reaction? Nevertheless, we give our prayer to our God. And because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. So they're asking God for help, but yet they're still making preparations as well. They're doing what they need to do. Now I want you to notice what happens to Nehemiah kind of all at once. Four different things that are brought in. First of all, Judah comes in and says, the strength of the laborers is failing. Then secondly, there's so much rubbish, we're not able to build a wall. And then they realize about the adversaries who say, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work. work to cease. And then apparently the people, the Jews, that were actually living nearby the enemies, were coming in and constantly, they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. So they're a source of discouragement, hopelessness, and they're in deep distress themselves. So Nehemiah focuses on the primary threat, the physical, even though this is coming at them from 4 different ways, he focuses on the primary threat, which is the physical attack. And he tells them, the people are kind of panicking, and so he gives them what they need to hear. Do not be afraid of them. Why? First of all, remember the Lord, great and awesome. That's their strength. That's who is with them. And then he gives them the motivation. Fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. It's not a long speech, but it's what needs to be said. And it keeps the people motivated, it keeps them focused, and it keeps them working. So the work continues, and everyone continues to work, but they've had to compensate. They've had to make some changes. So half of the people work on construction, while the other half, they're ready for war at any time. And we see that the leaders of Judah are behind them. They have the support of the leaders. And even those who are actually working in construction, even though that's their task, they have one hand on their sword and one hand on their burden, whatever they're actually doing. So they're constantly ready to fight. So you can imagine the work needs to slow down a little bit because of this threat. So Nehemiah recognizes, because of the expanse of the city, he sets up kind of a trumpet system and gets the people ready to rally and reminds them that God will fight for them and to go wherever they hear the trumpet. But notice the people, how do they work? They work from daybreak until the stars appeared. And he also at the same time says, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. When are these people sleeping? I don't see how they are. I mean, they're obviously sleeping, but they're getting very little sleep. Because, again, why? They're focused on the work. They're focused on what needs to be done. Threats come in. They're trying to slow them down, but it only intensifies their efforts and makes them more determined. And look, Nehemiah is part of this as well. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. So this is from the time they get up, from the time they get down, anything that can be cut out, everything is being focused on doing the work of the Lord and getting these walls rebuilt. So even Nehemiah, even though he's the leader, he and all of his people that are with him are making tremendous sacrifice. Alright, so that's how Nehemiah compensated for the problems. Now let's kind of take a side point and look at another problem that Nehemiah had to deal with, the problem of usury. So this would be the idea of loaning to somebody and then charging them some kind of interest and holding them in contract for that. So we're going to look at what's wrong with the nobles expecting this interest and repayment. And we want to look at Nehemiah's example as a leader and manager. We've been talking about this, but I want to summarize some of it as we go. So the problem of usury. So there arose a great cry from the people and the wives against the Jewish brethren. So it was the Jews who were perpetrating this. And it was said that our sons and daughters are many, let us get grain, so there's a shortage of food. And then some have said they mortgaged their lands and their vineyards and their houses to buy grain because of the famine. So this is a very difficult time. On top of all the work that's having to be done, there's a famine at this time. And so the people are having to deal with that in addition to all the work they have to do. So they borrow money to pay the king's tax on their lands and their vineyards. And now, what are they saying? Our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. What does that mean? They've come out of captivity, but they're going right back into it. They're going into bond servitude. They're becoming slaves. Their sons and their daughters are forced to be slaves. Daughters going into slavery. And they don't have the power to redeem it because the people that they've taken the loans from have taken hold of their lands and their vineyards. So they don't even have the way to get income now to actually pay back the debts. So what's Nehemiah's response? I became very angry when I heard the outcry on these words. Why would he be angry? So they're clearly violating the old law. What else? Yeah, they're doing it against their own people. They're in the middle of this great work that has to be done, and they're undercutting it. And here is their people that are in a time of need, and instead of actually helping them, they're actually using it to their advantage and to extract from them and extort wealth from them. So he gives a serious thought, and he rebukes the rulers and the elders, or the nobles and the rulers, and says to them, "Each of you is exacting usury from his brother." So I called a great assembly against them. And there's a few references where that's against the old law. So, in essence, what he says is, well, first of all, let's look at this question. According to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. Now, indeed, will you even sell your brethren, or should they be sold to us? And then what was their reaction? And they were silent and found nothing to say. And you can't help but think of Jesus working with the Pharisees when he would ask them a question, and they just had no answer. There was nothing they could say. And we've been talking about the elders lately in the sermons that Jeff's been preaching. And I think about silencing those who, convicting those who contradict. Here's another good example of somebody doing just that. So he said to them, "What you're doing is not good." And then he said, "Look, I'm lending them money and grain, but he's not extracting usury from them." So he tells them to give back all the things that they've taken, even give back part of the interest. And the response is, "We'll do it. We'll restore it. We will not ask anything." And then Nehemiah goes the extra step, and he makes sure that he takes an oath from the priests, who apparently were some of the worst at this time, to make sure that they will actually follow through and make good on their promise. And so the people do according to this promise at this time. So this is a problem that's taken care of. But yeah, long story, so look at Nehemiah and look at the example that he provides in this. First of all, he wasn't even involved in the usury, but look what else. "Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions, but the former governor." So he has access to special taxes, special provisions, being the governor, but he hasn't done this. The former governors, they did that, and even their servants ruled over them. But he didn't do it because of the fear of God, and because I also continued on the work of this of the wall. He didn't take opportunity to buy land, develop land. He has no interest in building up his personal wealth, his personal holdings. His entire focus is on getting this wall built. Even though he should have that luxury, that should be something that is his opportunity to do. So all of his servants are being focused on the work. "At my table were 150 Jews and rulers, besides those who came to us from the nations around us. Now that which was prepared daily was one ox and six choice sheep, also fowl prepared for me, and once every 10 days an abundance of all kind of wine. Yet in spite of this," so all of this that he was giving out of his own proceeds, he realized the need that was going on, and he was opening up his own wealth and helping out all these people, and he was feeding them himself. And in the meantime, he's not taking any of the income that's due him. "In spite of this, I did not demand the governor's provisions, because the bondage was heavy on the people." He recognized what was going on with the people. Again, here's one of these interjected prayers. "Remember me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people." Again, what's the focus of the leader here? What's the focus of Nehemiah? Is this an opportunity to exploit, to build up himself? No. It's entirely focused on helping other people, to help the ones that he's leading and that he's being a servant toward. So I'd like for us to think about a few verses that were referenced on the first slide. Leaders, a lot of times we talk about leaders, promoting leaders, we need more leaders, we need good leadership skills. But the Bible doesn't talk about that. The Bible talks about servants. It talks about those who are willing to lead. Look at what Jesus said. "But Jesus called them," these are the apostles, "to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. So whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." And there in John 13 as well, you're familiar with the washing of the feet. feet. And he says, you ought also to wash one another's feet, for I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you.
That is how leadership is accomplished, is through serving.
Alright, so let's get back to our question. What's some of the, let's try to pull some of this together. What are some of the qualities that we've seen thus far in Nehemiah that you think are exemplary as a leader? Qualities that we can emulate and that we can apply in our lives wherever we have opportunity and wherever we have influence.
First, learn how to serve.
Very good. So first he learned how to serve. What else?
In chapter 5, verse 9, we realize that living ungodly would cause them to lose the respect of their enemies.
Mm-hmm. So there was an awareness of this, of the respect, the esteem, what other people would look, or what other people would think. And so he's trying to make sure that the reputation is maintained. And there's great wisdom in that. What else?
Prayer.
Very prayerful. Again, this praying without ceasing. Anytime there's any kind of problem or any concern, he's immediately quick to do that. And I think that's an excellent model, actually, for Bible study as well. You can just see Nehemiah, as he's recording this, he's praying whenever there's a point of some kind of application where there's something he needs or something that he's thankful for. And that's a great model for us as well. As we're reading, as soon as we see something that's useful to us in our private study, of course, it's an excellent opportunity to stop and to pray and make application immediately and ask for help or thanks immediately. What else?
To really be organized, he put the people next to their own place, so he had a really good organization plan.
Right, right. And he was very perceptive about that. He was very good at that one case that we looked at where there's all these different things that are coming at him. He was able to focus on the primary threat and deal with that. Again, he doesn't stop or he doesn't hesitate to pray. But then he goes straight at the underlying problem. And he gives people the motivation and the strength that they need to do the task.
He's also very direct in his speech. So he can't see that commanders. Believe me when he goes there.
One of my favorite examples is actually in the next class. You think about Ezra when he was dealing with the problem of the marriage. When he found out about that, what did he do? He tore his clothes. He pulled out his beard. What does Nehemiah do when he finds out about that? He pulls out the beard of the people that were in the marriages. They're very, very direct. They're going at the people who knew better and the source of the problem. What else? Yes. Yes, he's leading by example. He's not asking them to do something that he's hesitating to do himself. He's actually the front sacrificing, probably more so than anybody else.
He wants to know the leaders, the priests, and held them accountable, made them swear to do as they promised.
Yes, so he put them in a public point and make sure that they follow through with that. Good point. Mark.
But there wasn't a sermon or a problem. He cared, he listened, and he answered. He didn't just say anything.
Yes, yes. So he was very much aware of the problems that the people faced, and he gave them an answer. He dealt with that. All very good points. And there were several things I came up with, and I'm going to go ahead and get to my key lesson slide early so the people that are going to have to get up and go get their kids can go ahead and see it for once. And we said a lot of these already, but just to review, first of all, this awareness, a concern, a sympathy, a love for God's people. Go back to his reaction at the very beginning. And we've seen all along, praying without ceasing. He stopped to survey the walls, to get a handle on the situation, to develop a plan. He was very quick when he had opportunity. He didn't hesitate to go and lead the return. He did that by faith. But when it came to actually meeting with the people and doing the nuts and bolts, he took everything in and he devised a plan and was prepared. He did his homework, so to speak. He was prepared going into it. All right. Think about the leaders. We talked about this. The Jewish leaders, they had a position, they had pride, but yet they gave that up. They may have to, it's something we may have to face, ridicule, scorn, intimidation, threats. These are all things that leaders, if we're going to be God's people, this is something we have to deal with. So we have discouragement from without,
we have discouragement from within. Remember the Techolites? They didn't put their shoulder to the work, but yet their families built that section of the wall and built another. So that's something that we have to learn about as well. And then think about the building of the wall. If we have a united effort where everybody is focused on doing something, think about how much can be done. We learned later that the wall was built in 52 days. And again, the people did this because they had a mind to work. I mean, we couldn't begin to do that today. And it's just amazing what these people gave up to get the work done. Again, Jimmy brought this up, his management skills, focus on the primary threat, not getting distracted. He knew how to deal with that and put the people in their place. Again, think about his speech that he gave the people, remembering the motivation, the source of strength, why. I mean, if you ask somebody to do something, and if it's difficult, the first thing they want to know is why. Why should I do this? Why should I be investing myself? Well, he answered that. He motivated them properly. You're going to be able to do it because of the Lord. Remember him, and then remember why you're fighting for your wives, for your families, your children, and whatnot. And we're going to have to burn the midnight oil. This is something that leaders, ability is part of it, but the other part of it is just time. You think about Jesus, how he sacrificed. Think about Paul laboring night and day to give an example. Think about the wise woman of Proverbs 31, about her handle takes hold of the distaff early in the morning, and then she's busy late at night. Again, this is part of that servant mindset that we've been talking about, where one is sacrificing himself. And then also, notice how there's all these, we would say, big things that are going on. Things that he has to take care of. They're trying to build a wall. They have armies that are trying to come and fight them. But yet, he's careful to make sure that they follow God's law carefully. Usury, I mean, it was a pragmatic problem, but it was also a matter of the law. And then we're going to talk about it a little bit. He stops to make sure that the genealogies are up to date and that everything's being taken care of. And one of the things they mention, even though this refers to Ezra's time, not Nehemiah's, is that there was people that needed Levites, but there were some that couldn't prove that they were Levites. And so they weren't allowed to be priests. Keeping God's law was more important than what was pragmatically necessary at the time. Again, thinking about not taking advantage of your brethren. And then we have a good example of somebody silencing those who contradict or convicting those who contradict by using a question, a very simple question, and referring them to the standard, to God's Word. And as we talk about leading through service and sacrifice, you're the last should be first. And the next two we're going to look at in just a second in the last few minutes. So as we go through chapter 6 and chapter 7, I like to notice a few other distractions that come upon Nehemiah. One of the questions I like to think about is, why did Nehemiah not visit with Tobiah? And I want us to contrast, the one we'll probably focus on more, is contrast Nehemiah's relationship building skills with those of the other Jews that were around him. Alright, so very quickly, we're just going to kind of go through the narrative just because we're running out of time. So Sanballat sought to meet with Nehemiah four different times. He sent a message in and said, come out here in the plains, come meet with me. There's something important that we need to talk about. And what was his true intentions? He was going to do him harm. He was going to kill him. He was going to take care of the problem right then and there. And what was Nehemiah's answer? I'm doing a great work. I'm busy. I don't have time for this. And so he stayed focused on the work. And this is still in the middle of the wall building. This is before the 52 days is concluded. So this is still something that could serve as a distraction. So finally, the fifth letter was open. It was threatened. It said, we've heard that you're going to be king and that you're setting yourself up and you're going to rebel as the king. So here's some more intimidation, accusation of treason and rebellion. Again, Nehemiah's response, no. And then he's told that he needs to go and flee for safety in the temple, that they're going to come and kill him. That was a trap. And he wasn't a Levite, if I recall correctly. It would have been sin for him to go in the temple. That was not been a place for him to hide. And then notice that the wall was finished in 52 days. This is an amazing feat. This is one thing I like for us to think about. Many in Judah were pledged to Tobiah. They were sending letters back and forth to Tobiah and the other Jews. This is people around Nehemiah. And some people, why was this? Some people were married to Tobiah, into his family, and he was married into their family. So he was intertwined with these families. He was not just some distant outsider. And so these people were constantly coming to Nehemiah and telling him all the good things that Tobiah was doing, trying to, you know, talk him up. And then they were turning around and they were telling Tobiah all the things they were reporting. They were spying on Nehemiah, telling him all the things that Nehemiah said. I think one of the applications that I see in this is I think about this area. There's so many Christians that have been here for so long. We have a lot of this as well. That when you just think about the congregation here and other congregations, it's hard to pick out one person or family who's not by marriage, you know, a cousin or an aunt or an uncle involved with somebody else. We have lots of different families that are intertwined. But yet, as we look at Nehemiah, when it comes to doing what's right and getting God's work done, did that matter? Was he afraid to rock the boat? No. None of those relationships, none of those things mattered. The only thing that mattered was staying focused on God's Word. And we'll see that next time even more so when he reacts the same way. So he's not fraternizing with the enemy, even though many others did. So here's an opportunity where common wisdom would say, well, let's build some bridges here. No, not Nehemiah. There's no bridges to build with these people. Alright, so other advancements that Nehemiah did. Let's talk about this very quickly. So the city was very underpopulated. There was not nearly enough people in the city at this time. And so he sets up governors who are basically guards or their watchmen, and they're responsible for the area where they live. And so he's being proactive about this and setting up kind of a guard force, not quite a militia, but getting the people more involved in watching out for their area of the town. And the other thing that he did is he was concerned about the genealogy. He gathered the people together to take the genealogy. And the thing that's actually recorded in chapter 7 is that he actually includes the genealogy that Ezra took. And he wants to make sure that that's lost and that's included as well. And again, there's this emphasis that's recorded there for us about how some of those Levites who couldn't prove which family they were part of, and so they were forbidden from being priests. I actually got done in the early days. Any other comments or thoughts before we close? Thank you so much for your time and your attention, and look forward to Jerry finishing up Nehemiah next time.